when I teach, for example, my psychology of the African American experience class, and I have a section on education, and I talk about stereotype threat, for many African American students, it's sort of like this aha moment. Like, I'm naming something that they have felt for a long time, but they didn't know that there was a name for it, that they didn't know that there was like research to describe what it was that they were feeling.
Hi, and welcome to Into the Fold, the Hogg Foundation podcast. I'm Ike Evans of the Hogg Foundation for Mental Health. Hogg Foundation is a mental health grant-making foundation and part of the University of Texas at Austin. To learn more about the history of the Hogg Foundation, as well as our numerous grant programs, visit www.hogg.utexas.edu. We are here today with Dr. Kevin Coakley, an associate professor of counseling psychology and African and African diaspora studies at the University of Texas at Austin. His research and training can be broadly categorized in the area of African American psychology. He is also editor-in-chief of the Journal of Black Psychology. And finally, he also happens to be a member of the Hogg Foundation's National Advisory Council. So, without further ado, Dr. Coakley, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Imani, for having me here.
Okay. You are a member of the Hogg Foundation's National Advisory Council. Mm-hmm. What I'm most interested in, though, is your own work and your own intellectual contributions to, you know, the ongoing conversation about race and stereotyping and their effects on psychological well-being, among other things. Mm-hmm. And in particular, a book that you just recently wrote, mm-hmm. The Myth of Black Anti-Intellectualism. You know, to be black post-civil rights era is to be, you know, constantly preached at about the value of education and mm-hmm. academic pursuits. And it always seemed to me that, well, to everyone, that there was more to the story. And so, what's, you know, if you could synopsize the evidence that black anti-intellectualism is a myth, what's there to say about it?
Well, let me provide a context before I answer that question for why I wrote the book. So I have been in academia now going on 17 years, and I have had a lot of interest in better understanding the psychology of African-American students, understanding what are their motivations, how do they see themselves as students, what are their attitudes towards school and education. And, you know, the one narrative that we continue to get about African-American students is that they don't value school, that they are anti-intellectual, and that this anti-intellectualism is a reflection of black culture in general.
Or that they see it as acting white.
or that they see it as acting white. And so I, you know, along with other, you know, social scientists, have been really interested in better understanding sort of what are the attitudes that black students have around school. And I have specifically sort of challenged the idea that black students are anti-intellectual. Now, as a social scientist and as a researcher and as a psychologist, I, you know, conduct empirical research, you know, in my case, quantitative research. But when you review the empirical literature, both sort of quantitative studies and qualitative studies, you do not find evidence that black students are anti-intellectual. In fact, you find just the opposite, that black students certainly, you know, value school as much as white students, if not more, at least based on sort of the reports of sort of large-scale surveys and smaller survey studies as well. And so when people make that sort of claim, you know, those of us who sort of challenge it will challenge it on the basis of empirical data, that empirical data don't support that notion.
Okay. So you're an African-American man, relatively young, living in a city, you know, that's often touted as particularly, you know, for Texas, fairly progressive. I am proud to say that I've been an Austin resident for most of my life, going back to when my family relocated here in the early 80s. And to put it mildly, I often find it rather challenging, you know, to negotiate issues of race. And it's almost as if around these parts, you know, the lack of overtness, it doesn't necessarily mean that there's any less mental bandwidth that's taken up by it. And so I know that you attended the State of Black Austin Community Forum. Mm-hmm. Hope that you got something out of it, and that, you know, they were able to get something out of your contribution. So I'm something of an anomaly myself, you know, being a black man under the age of 50, who can sort of see himself as second generation, longtime Austinite. So when you're invited to speak on the subject, what sorts of things do you find yourself emphasizing? I mean, I realize that there's just so much about living in a city like this, you know, that's worth talking about, but you know, what sorts of things, you know, preoccupy you on a consistent basis?
Well, I just want, as a, as a point of clarification, I attended as a citizen. So I actually wasn't on the panel itself.
Okay.
I was made aware that this community forum was taking place. And, you know, being a, you know, a resident, I wanted to know how other black residents feel about sort of the state of black, you know, Austin.
Yeah. Might you still have been kind of wearing your academic hat?
Well, certainly, especially given that the report that perhaps you're familiar with about sort of black out migration, you know, came from the institute that I'm the director of. And so I attended, and it was a very interesting discussion. There was quite a bit of discussion around gentrification and how sort of contentious of an issue that is. There were, you know, individuals who, you know, for example, there was one individual who was a teacher who also was a native Austinite, who said that he can no longer afford to live in Austin proper, and that he actually had to move, you know, perhaps to Pflugerville or to Round Rock just to be able to sort of afford a house, because he's basically priced out of the house that he had sort of, you know, and his family had kind of grown up in. So, you know, there were issues of just in terms of sort of can black Austinites afford to stay, you know, certainly in the East Side, which we know has been tremendously gentrified and continues to be gentrified. There's questions of whether gentrification is a bad thing or a good thing. One longtime resident of Austin, you know, who was, you know, pretty interesting character himself, indicated he didn't know if gentrification was a good or bad thing. Maybe it's a good thing, he doesn't know, but he said what he did know was that the people that he sort of grew up with, you know, can no longer afford to live in the homes that they sort of grew up in.
Right. And yeah, I mean, what's particularly striking about that is it never feels comfortable to broach the subject, because you know, there's a sense in which, by, you know, constantly carping on gentrification, it's almost as if you're kind of misplacing the blame for what's going on. You know, you've got you know, you have young overwhelmingly liberal, you know, Caucasians who are only, you know, taking the best advantage of the market forces that are in play. And it's a great example of the kind of conversation that's almost made, if anything, more difficult, because to some extent you're preaching to the converted, or at least you're preaching to those, you know, who in other contexts, you know, they express degrees of solidarity, you know, with people of color. And so that just makes it a tough conversation to have.
Well, it is a very tough conversation to have. And when you think about issues of social justice, it's one that it forces people to, you know, walk the walk if you talk the talk. And so, and what I mean by that is, and not just white people, you know, black folks and brown folks as well, that if you think that gentrification is a bad thing, that it sort of uproots, you know, sort of, you know, the citizens who've sort of grown up there, do you contribute to that by taking advantage of the market forces because you have the economic means by which to do so?
Right.
And that's not the conversation that people I hear are having, you know, publicly at least.
Yeah. It's always, I mean, And I realize, you know, there's so much to say about, you know, things like microaggressions and how those come into play when you're trying to, or you're just sort of dragged into, mm-hmm, trying to engage people who are just, you know, so outwardly,
right,
friendly and open and professedly liberal, mm-hmm. you know. So getting back to the relationship between racial and ethnic identity mm-hmm. and academic achievement, I'm sure that, you know, that you've come across the stereotype danger concept and probably even had opportunities to sort of witness it in action. So for those who don't know, you know, in your words, what is it, and you know, how big of an impact can it have?
Well, stereotype threat is a socio-psychological concept that was really created, if you will, for lack of a better word, by the African-American psychologist Claude Still at Stanford University. And it refers to this idea of the fear of essentially confirming negative stereotypes about one's group. The group can, you know, it's often sort of racial, but it can also be based on gender or other sort of social identity groups. But the fear of sort of confirming a negative stereotype, you know, within the context of school, you know, obviously, you know, an example that comes to mind is, you know, students of color, especially African-American students who recognize that the stereotypes about them as black students is that they aren't as intelligent as other groups and that their academic performance would sort of demonstrate that. And so going into, for example, a test-taking situation, a standardized test-taking situation, if this fear or concern is sort of present for students, the theory goes that this will depress or undermine their performance on the test in a way that it wouldn't if they weren't sort of preoccupied with sort of not confirming the stereotype, if that makes sense.
Right. So let me try to paint a picture that I hope makes this a little bit more concrete and gives people maybe a better understanding of what can be at stake. Mm-hmm. From my own experience, when I went from grade 6 to grade 7, I was going from a predominantly black elementary school into a magnet program that was overwhelmingly white, but also a fair percentage of you know, East Asian, South Asian descent mm-hmm. students. And I didn't have the vocabulary back then to describe what it was that I was feeling on a day-to-day basis mm-hmm. and how, over time, it kind of led to me shying away from STEM subjects and I guess increasingly beginning to identify with, you know, humanities. And I guess, you know, at the tail end of that, I ended up, you know, majoring in English once I was in college. And one thing that I've always wondered is, you know, I mean, what has emerged as far as interventions, if anything, you know, that could have helped somebody like me, you know, 20 years ago, kind of contextualize and make sense of what he was going through.
Wow, that's a yeah. great question. I know that there have been interventions sort of developed as a result of this work. I don't know that I'm current on the literature in terms of all the different interventions. I know that at a minimum, the one thing that can happen is to bring this stereotype threat sort of knowledge to the consciousness of students, because when I teach, for example, my psychology of the African American experience class, and I have a section on education, and I talk about stereotype threat, for many African American students, there's sort of like this aha moment, like I'm naming something that they have felt for a long time, but they didn't know that there was a name for it, that they didn't know that there was like research to describe what it was that they were feeling. So I think that one thing that can happen is to sort of educate students about this, you know, sort of phenomenon. Beyond that, it's to sort of remind students that you are here because your past academic achievements sort of indicate that you deserve to be here. And so while there's certainly a concern about perpetuating a negative stereotype, you know, about one's group related to, in this instance, intelligence, we, you know, And it's important to keep in mind the stereotype threat is theorized to really impact students who care about the domain of school. So if you're a student who really doesn't care about school and you've never really sort of done well, then stereotype threat is not really salient for you.
Right.
Does that
make sense? Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. Yeah.
But you know, if you are a student who is invested and identified strongly with school and doing well, and particularly as a black student, then you are more susceptible to stereotype threat. And so, you know, one intervention can be to just continue to sort of remind students about sort of their worthiness of sort of being on a college campus, that their past academic successes sort of indicate that they deserve to be there and that they are capable of sort of doing well. Cloud Steele sort of talks about this idea that you don't sort of develop remediation sort of programs to sort of help students because that actually causes students to be stigmatized, that you sort of work from the vantage point of you assume that the students are capable because they've shown in the past that they're capable and that any sort of intervention that you design operates from that assumption.
Okay. So for the benefit of any English majors who might be listening and thinking about my previous question, let me make it clear that I've decided to quit apologizing for my English degree as part of my own sort of personal, you know, journey toward, a coherent, you know, professional identity. So I don't mean to, you know, to give the impression that that it was any kind of an end point for me. But I just think it's interesting, how that unfolded. So I'm going to give you a chance now to talk about your employer, UT Austin, either, you know, to praise people who deserve it or, you know, to call out some things that you're seeing, whichever you're most comfortable with. Now, as somebody who works in communications here, we're all immersed in the UT culture of triumphalism, for lack of a better word. We're very self-celebratory. And maybe as branded a university as there is in the country, right? And, but again, as with Austin, also, you know, challenging for us, you know, as African-Americans and who know a little bit about the history of race relations here. But, you know, we now have a division of diversity and community engagement. We have a campus climate response team. So if you had your way, you know, what things would UT be doing yet more of? What things would be, scaled up, tweaked? It doesn't matter how simple or basic.
Well, let me start by talking about what I think UT has done well.
Sure.
We know, President Powers will be leaving after May. And I'm sure that we're all familiar with the sort of rather contentious relationship that he had with the Board of Regents and with Governor Rick Perry.
I've heard a little bit about it. Yeah.
The one thing that I will say about President Powers is that he has been an ardent champion and supporter of Black studies. He, you know, I would say more than any administrator, really put his money where his mouth was in terms of providing the material financial resources as well as sort of, you know, the intellectual support to be able to have, you know, now an African and African Diaspora Studies Department, this Institute for Urban Policy Research Analysis that I am the director of, and continued support for the Warford Center for African and African American Studies, which preceded both the Institute and the department. President Powers has been unyielding in his support of these three entities that comprise Black Studies, so much so that we will be recognizing and honoring him next month for all that he has done. So I want to say that, you know, just in terms of it being the figurehead, you know, and the symbol of UT, that UT has done well in that regard. Now, getting more specifically to your question, there's a lot more that can be done. You know, when I walk around campus and still see the abysmally low percentages of African-American students on this campus that do not reflect anywhere near the percentage of Black folks in the state of Texas, that continues to be a concerning problem, one that we need that UT I think needs to do better. Just to be sort of frank, creating the Black Studies Department was believed to be one means of trying to do that in terms of making UT a more attractive place and to kind of communicate to folks that UT is not the UT of old that was very hostile to Black folks. And certainly I think that has helped, but I think that UT still has a reputation of not being the most inviting place for Black folks, both students and staff and faculty.
Okay. And just to give a little bit of added context, I was also, an undergrad here. Okay. So, again, you don't have to tell me what has happened and what yet should happen.
Mm-hmm.
So, thanks. Mm-hmm. So, I think I'm almost at the end of my allotted time, so I'm just going to jump ahead real quick to popular culture, something
sure.
that you've written a few pieces on that mm-hmm. I just happened to come across,
mm-hmm.
In the course of looking for news to mm-hmm. go into our daily mental health news bulletin.
Mm-hmm.
And I think even at least one or two that I exerted. So how long has that been an interest of yours, and what do you get out of that kind of reportage?
So, I've been interested in issues of popular culture for really as long as I've been a professor, which is, now going on 17 years now, but I've never written about them. The reason that I've started writing about them is as a result of participating in this program called the Op-Ed Project. The Op-Ed Project is a project that was developed initially to increase the voices of women representation in the media. And it later expanded to people of color because, it's not, white males are the ones who dominate the op-ed pages and all these other sort of media venues. Well, this op-ed project, is in different universities, at Princeton University, I think at Yale University, Texas Women's University. And so a couple of professors here proposed the idea to administration, and administration thought it was a good idea, and so brought it here on campus. And so then they had to decide who would be a part of it. And so I was invited to be a part of it. I'm not sure what criteria they used, but perhaps it's because I was at that time the interim director of the Institute, and they thought that I would have some important things to say. So at any rate, that's how I became involved in it. And the Op-Ed Project is a wonderful experience because we are being taught by professional journalists whose job it is to write these other sort of op-eds, and they are well connected throughout all of the media outlets across the country. And so I'm working directly with a woman who has been wonderful. They tell us how to write op-eds, how to structure them, how to make them timely and relevant and salient.
Right.
So you strike while the iron is hot. So if something happens in popular culture, they want you to sort of jump on it immediately because you have a time frame within which it will still be relevant. And there have been times when I've sort of missed opportunities because, I didn't get it written in time enough. But it has been a wonderful outlet. I mean, and I have to be honest with you, in some ways it has brought me more satisfaction than even my academic pieces, because when I write an op-ed and I look and I see the number of likes, I'll just give you one example. The Bill Cosby situation, which has been a very contentious situation, and I took a pretty critical position of Bill Cosby. Well, I wrote that, it was published in the American Prospect, and it immediately started being circulated. There were over 600 Facebook likes, and it generated a discussion that my journal articles would never generate because most people don't read academic articles. And so I find that writing these op-eds is another way of sort of becoming, a public intellectual and helping me sort of engage people and to share my sort of thoughts and insights in a much broader way than I could just focusing on publishing in journals.
Oh, cool. I hope that means we're going to be seeing more of it.
I just published another one in the Huffington Post, a post-Ferguson sort of analysis on institutional discrimination and the denial of it.
It can be found now?
It can be found now.
I'll look for it.
Yes.
Yeah, thanks. Well, perfect. Dr. Coakley, thanks so much for finding the time to talk to me. And
certainly.
And your friends at Hog say hi.
All right. Well, hello, all. I look forward to seeing you all again.
Before we go, I have sad news to report. Somebody near and dear to us at the Hog Foundation, Stacy Babels, our Assistant Director of Finance and Operations, passed away on Sunday, April 5th, after a long and valiant struggle against ovarian cancer. And so, as you can imagine, hearts are pretty heavy around here at the office, but, you know, we're doing our best to soldier on like she would have wanted. And our hearts go out to her family and everyone whose lives she touched. And if you'd like to know more, you can check out our blog by going to our main website and just look for the link. But to put it mildly, we miss her very much. And that is it for this episode of Into the Fold. This is Ike Evans. Thanks for joining us.